Let's sit down and start talking. But we, the American people, have to put more pressure on our government, or it's going to be a long war of attrition that could explode into a much, much more disastrous Third World War.
Medea Benjamin, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of Code Pink, co-author of the new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. We'll link to your new article, Pentagon Leaks Punch a Hole in the U.S. Propaganda War. And again, Juan will be giving the keynote address at 10 a.m. Eastern Time at American University, talking about the search for a new U.S. policy for a new Latin America, burying 200 years of the Monroe Doctrine. Joining him in that day-long conference will be Medea Benjamin, Nick Estes, and others. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland police will wear body cameras at long last, 70 Portlanders weigh in on gun detection technology, and nurses rally in Seaside over working conditions. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, April 27th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. Portland has long been the largest city in the country to have a police force that doesn't wear body cameras. That's about to change. Portland City Council members voted unanimously Wednesday for police to start wearing those devices. City attorneys and the union representing police officers finally came to an agreement after almost 2 years of negotiation. Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown presented the details of the agreement during the City Council meeting yesterday.
What is in this body camera policy? I'm going to hit the highlights for you and happy to answer any questions, of course. I want to know what we started it with, the purpose of the policy. In this, we acknowledge that body cameras are an accountability tool that can enhance transparency and understanding of interactions between officers and the public. We acknowledge as well, they help police in building and maintaining public trust. I think that's a real interest of ours. And that was encapsulated in the policy itself right at the start. Who wears them? All on-duty sworn members in uniform assignment who are displaying a badge, who take part in CERT, patrol, traffic, public order event operations, and special duty work. We included in there an adjustment time for unintentional errors for a 60-day period. Intentional errors are always subject to discipline, even during that adjustment period. We included that officers must notify people when they are being recorded. And then we got into the next section, deals with activation. And we list out when a body camera must be turned on to record. We've included in there, one of the benefits of coming late to body cameras is that there's a lot of new technology out there, which is pretty neat. And one of the things is this automatic activation of the cameras. And so we have three instances where we've agreed that the cameras will just automatically turn on. When an officer turns on their overhead lights, that will start the cameras. When an officer takes out their taser, that will activate the camera. And third, when an officer draws their firearm, that will activate the camera. So automatically in those instances. Next, we got into when does the officer manually need to turn it on? So one, when they're dispatched to a call, they're required to turn it on. Second, when engaging with the public during a protest, they're required to turn it on, provided that it's allowed by law. When pulling someone over in their car or stopping a pedestrian, they're required to turn it on. When asking for consent to search or attempting to do a search, they turn it on. During certain custodial interviews of juveniles, they turn it on. And lastly, when the member develops reasonable suspicion or probable cause that a crime or violation either has occurred, is occurring, or will occur, they are required to turn it on. And that last aspect of the policy, when they have to turn it on, that's required by the state law on body cameras. So that language is pulled directly from state law. We have exceptions. We have times when an officer may mute or deactivate their camera. In particular, they have to deactivate their camera when they're interviewing a sexual assault victim, unless the victim consents and wants to have it turned on, and when in a medical facility. We next address when they stop recording. When they're done having contact with a person or participating in a call, the recording ends. We address the upload and the storage of footage. This was another issue the public had a lot of interest in. We said on the upload, it's at the end of the shift. For a use of deadly force incident, the supervisor will come and take control of the body camera, and then they will deal with ensuring that it gets to homicide detectives or wherever it's needed to get uploaded. On storage, we made it very clear in this policy that we do not allow for tampering with, for manipulating or altering content, or deleting recordings. Frankly, the camera itself, you cannot do it. It physically isn't possible on that camera.
That was Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown presenting the details of the agreement between Portland Police and Portland City Council. The last sticking point between the Portland Police Union and the city was about when officers could see their body cam footage after a use of force incident. The city wanted officers to write their reports before viewing their camera footage. The police union wanted officers to be able to view footage and then do their forms. As the agreement now stands, officers who seriously injure someone, use force against someone with a mental illness, or against someone who has been handcuffed, they'll have to give a recorded statement to their supervisor before viewing their body camera footage and writing their report. For the lowest levels of force, like pointing a firearm without firing it, officers will give a non-recorded statement to their supervisor before seeing the footage. When a Portland police officer kills someone, they will not be allowed to view their body camera footage until giving an initial so-called perceptual statement to an internal affairs investigator. Investigators will also be prevented from viewing the footage until after taking the officer's initial statement. The cameras are required under a settlement agreement between the city and the U.S. Department of Justice over police using excessive force against people in mental health crises. The Justice Department told the city in November 2021 that officers should not be allowed to view any footage before writing use of force reports. DOJ attorneys overseeing the settlement agreement tentatively signed off on these proposed policies, but noted that they don't satisfy all their initial requirements. Critics expressed concern that the camera policies were not made public until last week, depriving the public of an opportunity to provide feedback. Civil rights groups say some components of the policies limit their usefulness for holding police accountable. The Oregon Justice Resource Center, a Portland-based civil rights group, said the law requires police use of force to be reasonable based on what an officer knew when they used force. They want the officer's explanation as to why they used force to be based on what they perceived at the time, not what they were later able to see and hear on video. It's possible permitting review of footage gives officers the opportunity to justify their use of force based on the video rather than on the reasons that they actually used force at the time. After a 60-day pilot, the city and the police union will meet to discuss mutually agreeable modifications to the policies before they're fully adopted. Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "Today is a historic day for our city. After a decade of discussions and negotiations, we're finally able to move forward and implement a critical tool for transparency and accountability," end quote. Training on the cameras is expected to begin in August, and they will be given to select officers soon after. Over 70 Portlanders showed up to a virtual community meeting to weigh in on which gunshot detection service the city should employ. That was on Tuesday. The Focused Intervention Team Community Oversight Group, or FITCOG, recommended that Portland adopt this technology in hopes of reducing gun violence in the city. One company is Sound Thinking, also formerly known as ShotSpotter. Their pitch to cities is that they install microphones and listening devices across the city that are monitored by artificial intelligence and human workers to listen for gunshots and then send police to the area. They claim their service is 90% accurate and has only a half a percentage false positive rate. Sound Thinking, aka ShotSpotter, has a lot of critics, however, including in some other cities where they have services. Independent research has called into question their rate of success, and even if the service does correctly identify gunshots, it hasn't been connected to a decrease in gun crime in many cases. The other company is EAGL, or Eagle, which uses artificial intelligence only to analyze data from energy sensors, not microphones, in order to triangulate gunshots. They don't have a publicly available track record like Sound Thinking does, but they say their technology can detect a gunshot and differentiate it from other loud noises using the energy signature. One critique of the service is that it isn't clear how it would perform in a loud city environment like Portland. Initial spending for either of the services is relatively similar, but year over year, Eagle is cheaper. Community members voice concern about privacy, data, and overall effectiveness for both services. Some Oregon nurses are on the picket line today in the midst of contract negotiations with Providence Seaside Hospital. They say the increased cost of living is making it hard to keep nurses in the hospital at the current wages. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Nurses at an Oregon hospital are holding a rally to bring attention to wage issues that they say are making it hard to retain staff. Nurses at Providence Seaside Hospital are in the middle of contract negotiations. They'll be on an informational picket line today. Mary Romanaggi is a registered nurse in the emergency room at the hospital. She says pay isn't keeping up with the rising cost of living, such as expensive housing in the coastal town.
We've got a lot of new grads that are making not up to par wages compared to Portland, and it's just easier for them to become a travel nurse or go somewhere else where they can make more money and have a better life.
Romanaggi says nurses' wages at the hospital are behind the market. Providence did not respond to a request for comment. Romanaggi says nurses also are concerned about the new sick leave policy. She says in December, the hospital did away with an earned illness bank, which paid 100% of wages while employees were away. It was replaced with a short-term disability plan that pays 65% of wages.
Personally, I had 1,040 hours. I'm going on my 39th year, and they just wiped out my earned illness bank, and we want it back. It's a big deal.
She adds that nurses are paid at different rates across departments and says home health and clinic nurses are paid less than hospital nurses, even though they're doing similar amounts of work. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
House Republicans passed a debt limit bill tied to extensive spending cuts. The Montana House votes to censure a transgender lawmaker and calls Grow for a code of conduct and term limits for Supreme Court justices. With these stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We are the only party to take fiscal action in a sound mind that would lift the debt limit so we wouldn't have economic damage.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says it's now up to President Joe Biden to negotiate after Republicans approved a bill which would raise the debt limit but require cuts in federal spending, including Biden's climate change and student loan forgiveness programs. Biden has argued the debt limit should be raised without conditions. Congress has just 6 weeks before potential government default.
Absolutely reprehensible and needs to be condemned in the strongest possible terms. I really find it shocking.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski reacts to news of a leaked Supreme Court opinion on overturning Roe v. Wade last summer. Now Murkowski is introducing legislation to require a new code of conduct for the justices. Calls to expand the size of the Supreme Court and ensure ethics standards have gained traction following recent financial disclosure scandals involving Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Neil Gorsuch. An audio recording of Senator Ted Cruz reveals the Texas Republican advocated for the creation of an electoral commission to verify claims of voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Cruz is heard telling Fox News staff voters should have a credible assessment of claims regarding potential voter fraud.
The mechanism to try to force that is denying certification on the 6th.
The recording was leaked by a former Fox News producer. In it, Cruz says he organized 11 senators to object to President Biden's electoral certification on January 6, 2021. Cruz dismissed the recording, saying he publicly called for the same strategy on the Senate floor. Montana House Republicans have voted to censure Zoe Zephyr, a transgender Democratic lawmaker, for what they say are breaches of House decorum. Zephyr told lawmakers last week they would have blood on their hands if they voted for a bill to ban gender-affirming medical care for transgender children. Zephyr says other lawmakers have screamed at her in House chambers and faced no repercussions.
So we're seeing a very undemocratic application of what it means to have decorum.
Zephyr will be barred from the House floor and gallery for the remainder of the session, but is able to vote remotely. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson has announced his candidacy for president, citing his consistent conservative leadership.
I bring that same vigor to a fight in another battle, and that battle is for the future of our country and the soul of our party.
Hutchinson has called on former President Donald Trump to drop out of the race, saying the country needs a candidate who is not focused on the past. And Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont says he will not run for president in 2024 and will instead endorse President Joe Biden's re-election. Sanders says the progressive movement's job is to make sure Biden fights for the working class. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Debt collections can lead Oregonians into poverty. As Eric Tegedoff reports, legislation in Salem would provide people with greater protections.
Predatory lending practices can leave people in a cycle of debt and even drive them into poverty. Legislation in Oregon would strengthen protections for consumers. House Bill 2008 would provide a number of protections for Oregonians. Currently, debt collectors can leave people with as little as $250 per week. Chris Coughlin with Oregon Consumer Justice says the bill would increase this amount substantially.
This will allow Oregonians to make reasonable payments on their debts while maintaining minimum wage amounts to meet basic needs and protect against the risk of homelessness.
Coughlin says Oregon has some of the weakest protections against aggressive debt collecting in the country. In a report from December, the National Consumer Law Center gave the state a D grade for its laws. Coughlin says the bill also protects people's bank accounts from seizure and collection cases. HB 2008 is scheduled for a public hearing in Salem today. Wally Walls was caught in medical debt because of the high price of insulin and after a stay in the hospital. He says debt collectors hounded him.
It was awful. It was never ending. It's all I could think about. My phone would ring nonstop off the hook multiple times a day. Even if I answered them and said I couldn't pay, they would call me back.
Wall says he was working full-time at a dog kennel when collectors told him they wouldn't accept partial payments of his debts.
That's when the garnishments came, and I had to get a second job because only taking home $250 a week isn't enough to barely survive, let alone be garnished. So I got a second full-time job at Burger King down the road.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Expressions, a celebration of drag and transgender rights happening Saturday, April 29th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. Stick around at 6 for Rose City Native Radio, then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be lovely and sunny with a forecasted high of 84. Today in history, in 1927, American civil rights leader Coretta Scott King was born. She was married to Martin Luther King Jr. and continued to fight for equality for Black Americans until her death in 2006. The quote of the day is from King. She said, quote, "Struggle is a never-ending process. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation." We'll be right back. A commission on the Department of the Interior's Not Invisible Act met in Anchorage, Alaska, to hear testimony from victims and advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous people. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Public hearings on missing and murdered Indigenous people were held this week in Alaska. Vivian Corthia sits on a commission created by Congress to address the problem. She says more than 300 Alaska Native people are on a missing and murdered registry.
To me, that's the same size of a village, a whole village. And it's shocking to know that there's that many people were missing.
The Not Invisible Act Commission met in Anchorage to hear testimony from victims and advocates working to prevent violence. They identified a range of problems, including a lack of services for vulnerable people and too little law enforcement in rural Alaska. Systemic racism and trauma were reoccurring themes. Several advocates told the commission that it's hard to make federal programs work in rural Alaska, especially for small tribes. Dana Deal, Director of Wellness and Prevention at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, says federal grants are not easily tailored to community needs.
Oftentimes the scope of our funding is very limited and narrow, but from an Alaska Native perspective, we see things more holistically, and you can't separate things like mental health, physical health, and spiritual health.
The commission invited family members of missing and murdered Indigenous people to testify during an afternoon session that was closed to the media. By October, the panel is to produce recommendations on how the federal government can better prevent and respond to violence against Native Americans and Alaska Natives. The North Dakota legislature has passed a bill that codifies the Indian Child Welfare Act in the state. Representative Jamie Davis, whose Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians successfully led the passage of House Bill 1536. Davis introduced the bill as the U.S. Supreme Court considers the fate of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which seeks to keep Native children with Native families. Under the bill, if the High Court does make changes to the federal law, the changes would not apply in North Dakota unless the legislature chooses to amend it in the future. In a statement, Davis says a repeal or significant change to ICWA by the U.S. Supreme Court could have negative impacts on American Indian and Alaska Native children, and that protecting ICWA in North Dakota protects Native children. The bill passed 46-0 in the Senate and 91-1 in the House and now heads to the governor. A Colorado News Collaborative recently released a report highlighting the experiences of Indigenous communities with the media. It also includes solutions on improving that relationship. KUNC's Emma Vandenhainde reports.
CoLab's Indigenous Voices report gathered Indigenous leaders and community members for discussions. The group frequently mentioned how they felt invisible in the media. They also said the coverage of issues important to them was very superficial.
The less that the community is covered in a human and depth way, the more those stereotypes persist or become deeper ingrained.
That's Tara McLean Manthe, a citizen of the Osage Nation in Oklahoma and the project leader. The report focuses on three areas of improvement: reach, representation, and respect. Some specific solutions mentioned are building trust in reporting relationships, getting Native journalists in the newsroom, and educating journalists about Native history through training. CoLab plans to meet with Indigenous leaders, journalists, and funders to share the information and help put these solutions into action. The report is available on the CoLab website. For National Native News, I'm Emma Vandenhainde.
This story is distributed by the Mountain West News Bureau, which contributed to the report. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Wednesday was Denim Day, commemorated in Nevada to show support to victims of sexual assault. While lawmakers say they're proud of the laws they have passed to help bring justice to survivors, they know more can be done. Alex Gonzalez has the story.
Nevada lawmakers on Wednesday recognized Denim Day to rally against sexual violence by wearing denim during the Senate floor session. Denim Day began after an Italian Supreme Court ruling overturned a rape conviction when the justices alleged the victim, who was said to have worn tight jeans, might have helped her attacker remove them, implying consent. Senate Majority Leader Nicole Cannizzaro, who worked as a prosecutor for more than a decade, says when survivors of sexual crimes come forward to share their experience, they're often blamed for what happened.
I know that we can do better for survivors and for victims. And so I just want everyone to know that the denim that you see today is a statement that no one deserves or asks to be a victim of sexual violence or sexual assault.
Kenny Zaro says she's proud of the work the Nevada legislature has done to help destigmatize and support survivors of sexual violence. She says since 2017, the state has passed laws to accelerate timelines for rape kit processing, as well as expand privacy protections for people who've been taken advantage of by those who use their authority to commit sexual assault. According to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, or RAIN, an American is sexually assaulted every 68 seconds. One in six women has had to deal with the threat of rape, but men and boys are also victims of sexual violence, as one out of every 10 rape victims is male. Democratic Senator Melanie Scheibel calls it heartening to see how many of her colleagues were wearing denim in Wednesday's session.
We stand in solidarity with victim survivors, and we'll continue to fight to make this a better place for them to live, where they have equal access to justice.
Lawmakers realize there's a lot of work still to be done. RAIN states the vast majority of perpetrators don't see any prison or jail time for their crimes. Out of 1,000 sexual assaults, 975 perpetrators walk free. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
A state government official in Texas has announced that employees who come to his office not dressed in, quote, a manner consistent with their biological gender, end quote, will face consequences. It's another in a list of hostile actions aimed at LGBTQ people, which will likely lead to new lawsuits the state will need to defend. Roz Brown reports.
New lawsuits are likely coming to Texas as LGBTQ people working for the state are now being targeted in dress code regulations. Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller has issued an order to his employees to dress in a manner consistent with their biological gender as part of a dress code and grooming policy. ACLU of Texas attorney Brian Klosterboer says the new policy violates Title VII, which bans employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, as well as the First Amendment's right to free expression and the Equal Protection Clause.
Unfortunately, it sends a pretty devastating message to people who work at this department that they're not welcome if they deviate at all from gender stereotypes.
The memo, dated April 13th and signed by Miller, says those found to be in violation will be asked to go home and change. It further states those who don't adhere can face remedies up to and including termination. The agency's previous dress code restrictions did not reference biological gender. Klosterboer believes state agencies should be focused on doing their jobs, not trying to make political points by discriminating against their own employees.
They're trying to take us back in time to the decades when the government and private employers could and openly did discriminate based on gender, but that really defies modern court precedent as well as the regulation from federal agencies.
As Ag Commissioner, Miller is known for his fondness of Western wear. To that end, his new dress code encourages Western business attire, including boots, but not open-toed shoes for women.
It's just pretty absurd that people are allowed to wear Western wear, but not to dress consistently with their gender identity. And it's unclear and vague how they're even going to enforce this. Are they going to be picking and choosing between cowboy hats, which one is too masculine or feminine?
The Agriculture Commissioner has previously advocated for statewide legislation to restrict gender-affirming care for transgender children. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Diné College in Salie, Arizona, has a leading role in serving the educational needs of the Navajo Nation, but also has helped foster economic developments in the area. Alex Gonzalez speaks with one professor who shares how her program has shaped life on the reservation.
A tribal college in Arizona has gotten some national attention this spring for community college excellence, in this case on the Navajo Nation. Diné College in Salie, Arizona is mentioned in an Aspen Institute report for the work it's doing to boost the local economy in an area without many industry partners or employment opportunities for graduates. Shazia Tabassum Hakim is a microbiology professor at the college and says it's been able to use grant opportunities to invest in economic development and sustainable business practices. Since 2020, Hakim has led a 10-week program to train students to become water scientists in their community.
We should be able to train the local workforce because it not only helps the communities to get more out of what they have learned, but also it is needed to continue the chain because they are going to be examples.
Hakeem says Diné's water testing program is one example of an initiative that meets Navajo needs, but also helps deliver students to potential jobs. She adds the response from students in the community has been overwhelmingly positive. Hakeem says her program has led to greater awareness of safe water needs for people living on the reservation. And while the USDA grant that has made the program possible will end this year, she says the college will find a way to continue the work. Given the tribe's history with uranium mining, which led in the past to contaminated water sources and other health-related issues, Hakeem says it is paramount that people know how to properly identify water contamination.
It is not something that we are trying to stop at any point. So now our students, we have trained them in a way just like master trainers, so they are good enough in all these basic testing and other techniques.
The Aspen Institute report says the college has also decided to start its own businesses, one of which is to produce wool, since sheep ranching has been a cultural and economic staple for those in the area. The school's efforts have led to improved economic outcomes for tribal workers. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 27th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, tips, and curiosities at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Emma Lugo. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, Roz Brown, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including this here Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.